Hello, and I just want to echo what Sarah said. Thank you for coming out this evening and listening to us. Crossword puzzle constructors and solvers tend to be kind of a close-knit group and a bit introverted, so it's nice to get all of us together in one room. So I'm going to go first, and in a minute here, I'm going to walk you through the process of constructing a crossword puzzle. This is one that I wrote a few years ago and many of you picked up a copy as you came in, and if you didn't, you can run over there and grab one. But as it says down at the bottom, this was about 6 years ago, very close. This is a puzzle I had published in the New York Times. But before I get into that, let me just give you a little bit about my history. Currently, I'm an Ann Arborite in the sense that I came here to go to University of Michigan and I never left. And I've been teaching high school mathematics in Ann Arbor for the last 30-some years. And I didn't get into crossword puzzle construction until about 10 years ago. In fact, my first publication was 10 years ago this month in the USA Today. So I'm approaching my 10th anniversary of being a published crossword puzzle constructor. But the way I got into constructing was I wasn't mentored by anybody. I just kind of leaped in head first at one point in my life. I wasn't even that avid of a solver at the time, but I was becoming more and more interested in solving crossword puzzles, and I picked up a crossword puzzle book. And the book I picked up was by Will Shortz, the editor of the New York Times Crosswords. And it was, the title of the book was something like Will Shortz's Favorite Crossword Puzzles, and it was filled with 100 crossword puzzles, all of which I kept flipping the pages, and at that point, I wasn't a particularly good solver, but I was just enamored with the creativity and just the beauty of some of the puzzles I found in there, and it just lit my creative juices. Is that a mixed metaphor? I don't know. But I decided something, a switch flipped in me, and I thought, this is something I've got to try, because this just looks really cool, really fun. So I dove in head first without any mentoring, and literally I had a piece of graph paper, a pencil, a dictionary, and a big eraser, and I just tried constructing a crossword puzzle, and day after day, night after night, to the point where I think my wife, who's just walking in the room, thought I'd lost my marbles. Right, honey? Hi, honey. She may have been right. Maybe I did lose my marbles. But I don't know. I felt driven to do it. And I ended up submitting a puzzle to the New York Times to kind of crack the door open. I had met Will Shortz once briefly in the mid-90s at one of his barnstorming tours for NPR. If you donated so much money to the local NPR station, you got to go to this wine and cheese thingy or whatever. And I met Will Shortz there. So I sent him an email with, you know, saying, hey, you know, you probably don't remember me, but I met you at the blah, blah, blah. And I said, and by the way, here's this crossword puzzle I'd like you to consider. And he was, you know, it took a couple months to hear back from him. And he was very polite, but he, you know, step by step, bullet point by bullet point, he told me why it was a piece of garbage, basically. Because I had violated a lot of the rules that are expected to be followed with crossword puzzle construction. Will's going to touch on some of that, I think, a little later and show you some of the online sites you can go to find out what the rules are. So I kind of went in blind, but he was very polite, and he was actually very encouraging to me. So I stuck with it. The next puzzle I think I sent to him, maybe it was two puzzles later, he emailed me back and he said, well, this one's really close, but for reasons I'm not going to go into, I'm going to say no. And I never found out what the reasons were. I still kind of wonder to this day why he didn't accept that one. But I sent it off to the USA Today and kind of forgot about it. You know, it's in the back of my mind, but it's not part of your day-to-day life. And a couple months, 3, 4, 5 months went by, I can't remember. But I got to tell you, there's nothing like the thrill you get when you open up your email and it's like, congratulations, you know, the first time you get a puzzle published. So that was a real, it kind of validated all my my months of losing my mind, hunched over a piece of graph paper. So anyway, from that point forward, I was pretty successful, and I've had, I think, over 150 puzzles published overall in various publications, New York Times, LA Times, Wall Street Journal, what am I forgetting, Chronicle of Higher Education, USA Today. So, and I've had over 90 in the New York Times. And I thought what I would do is walk you through kind of the process of constructing a crossword puzzle. When people find out I construct crossword puzzles, sometimes they say, oh, okay, and then they walk across the room to find somebody else to talk to. But often they show at least some level of interest, and it seems like the same questions come up over and over again. Common questions are, how long does it take you? That's a very common question in talking to Tracy and Will. They get the same question, too. People are interested in how long it takes to construct a crossword puzzle. And unfortunately, difficult question to answer because so much of the effort is spent in coming up with themed ideas. And this might be something you do while you're walking your dog, driving your car, falling asleep at night. You know, your mind is racing through things that would make a good crossword puzzle, be a good entry in a crossword puzzle. So I don't know if you consider those billable hours when you tally up how much time it takes to write a crossword puzzle or not. So I usually tell people it takes somewhere like 8 or 10 hours. You know, that's my best estimate. Other things people want to know, if they're indelicate, how much do you get paid for this, or do you get paid for this? And the answer is yes, you get paid for it. And right now, the major publications, the New York Times is the highest paid, and they pay $300 for a daily puzzle, a Monday through Saturday puzzle, a 15 by 15 puzzle. And then the Sunday puzzles, which are bigger, 21 by 21, they pay $1,000 for those. So it's quite a bit more work that goes into those. Anyway, so if you have other questions that you'd like to have answered, file them away in the back of your head. And like Sarah said, afterward, we're going to be up here on the stage and they'll walk around with the mic and you can ask us. So, we would just ask that you hold the questions until that point in time, because it's really important for them to have the mic in front of you so they can pick it up on the videotape, they tell me. Okay? Are there any questions? See, that was a trick. Just want to see if you're paying attention. Okay. So anyway, on to this puzzle. Well, before I flip to the next slide, it's just going to be, like I said, step by step. It'll take me 3 or 4 slides to go through the blank grid all the way up to, you know, getting it filled in. And a couple of things that I've discovered in talking to people who do crossword puzzles even fairly regularly, sometimes they haven't noticed things about crossword puzzles. Like typically a grid, I know you probably can't see this, but if you've got one in front of you, typically a grid has some kind of rotational symmetry to it, right? Is there anybody who did not know that? My wife and daughter raised their hand, let the record show. So I'm going to ask a question. Mary, how many crossword puzzles have you done in your life? This is my wife. I'll answer that for her. She's done one crossword puzzle, and it was the one that I wrote for our daughter's wedding about 3 months ago. So it's not a hobby we share. Okay, but anyway, yes, most puzzles have symmetry, and the vast majority that have symmetry have what's called rotational symmetry, meaning that if you took the grid and rotated it 180 degrees, the pattern of black and white squares would look identical, right? So I would say of the puzzles, and of course, all of these rules can be broken. There are some puzzles out there that have no symmetry at all, but the vast majority that have symmetry have rotational symmetry. Some can have left-right symmetry, as if you folded it over. Like, I'm a math teacher, so symmetric about the y-axis. Occasionally, you'll see them that are symmetric about the x-axis, very rare, and even diagonal symmetry. But most have rotational symmetry. As does this one. So let's get into this. So as I mentioned, this was published on Wednesday, December 9th of 2009. And let me backtrack for a second, sorry. Not only does the grid have symmetry, but the themed entries almost always have symmetry too. Meaning that if you've got a 10-letter themed answer in row 3 from the top, in the left-hand corner, you're going to have another 10-letter themed entry in row 3 from the bottom in the lower right-hand corner. So that adds a lot of difficulty to the crossword puzzle construction process, because not only are you confined with symmetry in the grid, but you're also confined to symmetry within the themed answers. And you might think, a good question is, why do they have to have symmetry? Well, they really don't, but I think it's just the aesthetics of it. I think it just looks nicer when you get a crossword puzzle, even if you don't realize it. you might not study it and notice the symmetry, but I think there's some part of your subconscious that notices things like that and is drawn to that kind of a pattern, a symmetric pattern. So anyway, the impetus for this puzzle is somehow I got the phrase, you know, this is going to be a spoiler alert for those of you who haven't finished the puzzle, but the idea, the phrase New World Order came to my head, and I thought, wow, well, you could take that literally and take the letters in world, W-O-R-L-D, and rearrange their order. Therein is the seed of a crossword puzzle theme. So what I did is I brainstormed while I was walking the dog and driving the car and falling asleep at night, and tried to come up with phrases that have those five letters, W-O-R-L-D, consecutively in their midst. And I really, for elegance, I really tried to keep it to two-word phrases, or at least hyphenated phrases or compound words, where the W-O-R-L-D would span both words. Sword lily, blow dryers, feel drowsy, field work. Okay. Also, I wanted to put the constraint in that I wanted a different order every time. So the first one, you can see I'm going to try out this pointer, the W-O-R-D-L. I didn't want to repeat that W-O-R-D-L, so I wanted a new permutation every time I did this. Okay. Then I also had to build in the theme revealer, the New World Order, as one of the themed entries. Since it's 13 letters and none of the other ones are 13 letters, I was kind of forced to put it in the middle of the grid for it's symmetric with itself, so to speak. It doesn't have a symmetric partner. So I had to, you know, brainstorm, and I can't remember now, it's been too long, I may have had other possibilities that I had to discard because for symmetric reasons, or sometimes they're just kind of clunky. Even among these ones that I accepted, I think something like feel drowsy, that's not a great phrase. And I think if I had that in a grid as just a piece of fill, the editor might not accept it, but they tend to be a little bit more lenient when it's a themed entry. Feel drowsy is just, it's a phrase, all right, but it kind of falls into the green paint category, as they say in the business, meaning, yeah, green paint is a thing, but if you put green paint in a crossword puzzle, that's just kind of weird when you just attach an adjective and a noun together. So feel drowsy, that's a little iffy. So anyway, once I settled on my four themed entries and my theme revealer, I place them in the grid. And another thing about that theme revealer, it's a little, I'm not crazy about putting it in the middle of a grid because it's better to have it down near the bottom because people typically work the puzzle from top to bottom. And it's nice to have that aha moment at the end, I suppose, rather than, you know, letting the cat out of the bag right here in the middle and then you know what's coming for the rest of it. I was going to say something else about that. Oh, well. Anyway, once I decided on these entries, I stuck them in the grid, and that kind of decided where certain black squares had to go. Because of symmetry constraints, the three black squares up here match up with the three black squares down there, you know, the one here and the one there. Okay, so I placed those in order, or I placed those black squares in the position. And then the next step is to put in the rest of the black squares. And there are constraints here, too. You can't just throw in as many black squares as you want. Typically, you're limited. For a daily puzzle like this, you should probably have no more than 38 black squares. But again, every rule of crossword puzzle construction can and has been broken. Also, you're typically limited on a daily puzzle, if it's a themed puzzle, to only having 78 words in the puzzle. Now, if there are any people out here, I've got a lot of my students from here in high school, who some of them took a calculus test today. Sorry, I won't have it graded by tomorrow. and a quiz to some other classes, too. But anyway, the way it works, if you're not familiar with most daily publications like the New York Times, LA Times, is Monday is the easiest. It's kind of the gateway drug. If you're getting into crossword puzzles, you want to start with a Monday, and then as the week progresses, they get successively more difficult. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday is really hard. Saturday is a killer, but then Sunday is bigger. It's the 21 by 21, and it tends to be kind of midweek, maybe Wednesday, Thursday-ish in difficulty level, because people want to wake up on a Sunday, lie in bed, and do the crossword puzzle or have their bagels and coffee, and they don't want to be stressed out. So the Sunday puzzle is a challenge, but nothing like a Saturday puzzle. So anyway, I picked the puzzle here. I picked the Wednesday puzzle. This is kind of middle of the road. Oh, I know what I was going to say earlier. And then I put circles in this one. not all crossword puzzles have circles, and a lot of times when I pass out a puzzle to my students after I have it published, and they say, what's with the circles? And I usually just have to say, well, do the puzzle and it'll be self-explanatory somewhere along the way. Usually there's something that refers to the circles in one of the clues, or else it's very obvious once you've filled in the puzzle correctly what the reason for the circles is. Okay, so once you get the themed entries, the theme revealer in place, that dictates where some black squares go. And then you kind of look for trouble spots. Like you probably wouldn't want to end a word in a Q or a J, okay? Letters like an S, those are friendly letters just about anywhere, but especially at the end of a word. So you want to try to leave yourself as much leeway as possible, but also keeping in mind that you don't want to end a word in a Q or a J, but there is some benefit to having Q's and J's and X's and Z's in your grid. They tend to spice things up. They call those scrabbly letters because in the business because they have high Scrabble counts if you're a Scrabble player also. So there's a premium on those as well, as long as, you know, it's a balance. You don't want to compromise fill by cramming a bunch of Z's and X's into a grid and having some less than optimal fill somewhere else. So you got to walk that tightrope. Okay, so the next thing I did is I kind of played that game, and there's a lot of, you know, give and take and erasing, essentially, deciding where to put the black squares and deciding you've kind of painted yourself into a corner, green painted yourself into a corner, and, you know, you get a spot that you didn't see initially that is difficult to fill, so you got to back out and rearrange the black squares and move forward. So it's always, you know, two steps forward, one step back. So what I did next is I settled on this pattern of black squares. And I think this is probably a 78-word puzzle, and it's probably got 38 black squares. It's probably the maximum. It's close to it anyway. So once I decided on this, then I would look for potential trouble spots. So you want to go for the areas that are going to be difficult to fill first. You know, there's no sense in starting with the easy stuff and then working your way to something that's undoable and then having to just back way out and start all over again. So the things I looked for were like this entry here that crosses three, we're locked in at three places, three letters, the O, the L, and the W. So there's not a whole lot of things that can fit in there. And the thing I came up with is it's not my best work, I'll admit, but it worked. And then a couple other long entries, like over here, the E, what is this, an eight-letter entry here, and then the symmetric one over here somewhere over here. Oh, it also involves two E's. E's are pretty friendly letters, so I probably had a little bit more a few more choices in those cases. So anyway, I decided on omelets up there and exterior there. So I did manage to squeeze an X in a fairly confined corner. I don't feel like I'm, you know, cramming it in because exterior is a nice long word with the X in it, and this should be fairly easy to fill here, that kind of a thing. And, you know, it's interesting. I did this 6 years ago, and I was wondering this evening, if I were to do this over again, I wonder if I would get a better product, and I hope I would. I think I've learned a lot since then. And I did start out, like I said, just with a pencil and a paper and a dictionary, but I progressed from there, and now I do use online tools and some professional software, and Will's going to talk about those things in a little bit, so I'll let him discuss that. So once those were in place, then the next step was just fill in the grid. So you just go bit by bit and try to make things as lively as possible, and you try to stay away from partial phrases like it at, you know, where is it at, or something like that. You want to stay away from abbreviations as much as possible. You want to limit the number of proper nouns because a few are good, they just kind of add variety, but if you have too many, the trouble with proper nouns is, like if I put Beyonce in the puzzle, I mean, you either know it or you don't. You can't really infer it, no matter how many letters you get in something like that if you're not familiar with Beyonce. And you want to try to stay away from crossword-ese words as much as possible, and you know what I mean, if you do crossword puzzles a lot, words like aria, A-R-I-A, Oreo, era, you know, words that come up way more often proportionally in crossword puzzles than they do in general conversation. So, yeah, that's a challenge. But you got a lot of leeway. You got a lot of options usually, and it takes a while to fill it in. I filled it in, so it looked like that. There, if you avert your eyes, if you don't want to know all the answers. And then once it's filled, then the next step is cluing. I, as a constructor, when I submit it, I submit my own list of clues, mail it off, and then I wait. And it can be anywhere. I've heard in as quickly as 2 weeks on a puzzle, and sometimes I've waited over 6 months to hear back. And it's one of three things. The editor will say, yes, it's great, I love it, I'll publish it. No, thank you. Or maybe. And the nice kind of maybes are like, well, there's a word in the upper right-hand corner that I'm not crazy about. Could you just redo that corner? And usually that's a quick fix. But sometimes he'll come back and say, well, I like the concept, but, you know, feel drowsy, really? We're going to go with that? Do you think you could find a different entry to put in that place? And then you're like, oh, okay. And that pretty much means reworking the whole puzzle, because you might want to switch the order of the themed entries to get things to mesh a little better. So, yeah. So, yes, no, and maybe are the three answers. So then, as I was saying, when you submit it, you submit the completed grid, and you submit your list of clues. And Tracy's going to play a little fun game with you later involving clues. But I think there's often a misconception among people who don't do crossword puzzles often that, you know, to make a puzzle hard, what you want to do is cram it with really obscure, arcane words and knowledge. You know, you've all heard like the cliche kind of like South American beetle or something like that, or Albanian coin. And that may have been the case 30 or 40 years ago. But nowadays, to ramp up the difficulty level on a puzzle, to go from a Wednesday to a Thursday to a Saturday or something, a lot of it's in the cluing, to make the clues a little bit more vague, a little bit more wordplay involved, a little bit more obscure. So you might have the same entries in a Monday puzzle and a Saturday puzzle, but the cluing is going to be the thing that's much different between those. And a lot of the fun, frankly, in doing a crossword puzzle is the wordplay involved in the clues. You'll look at something and you'll think, how can that be? There's no way there's a three-letter word that fits that clue. And then when you fill it in and the light bulb goes on, you realize that you were trying to think outside of the box, but you weren't far enough outside of the box. And Tracy's got a bunch of those to play with you later. So anyway, I submit the grid, I submit my list of clues. The editor, if he does accept it, when he publishes it, often he will redo many of the clues. Some of it's just because he doesn't like your clue. Some of it is because he wants to either ramp up or ramp down the difficulty level. So, you know, if you clued it thinking, oh, this might run on a Tuesday, and he decides to run it on a Thursday, you know, he's going to tweak the clues and make them that much harder. Some of it can be just as mundane as you clued apple is popular fruit or something, and he used apple 3 days ago in a puzzle and he clued it popular fruit or something similar. So he might want to go to the computer product, you know, something like that. So, and then occasionally the editor might not only tweak the clues, but he might take a corner and say, and without even asking you, just redo it. Usually it's a fairly minor fix up if he does something like that. If it's major at all, he'll throw it back at you most of the time. I think that's about it for me. And as I said, if you've got any questions, file them away in the back of your head, and you can ask me later. And then the last slide is just what you've got in front of you. If you didn't pick one up, I think there's still some on the table over there. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Will.
So as Pete said, I'm going to talk about some of the technology that crossword constructors can use to help them with the construction and the cluing and everything that Peter just explained. I guess I should introduce myself a bit first. So my story is kind of similar to Pete's story. I got started out in a similar way. So I didn't have a mentor. I just sort of took some graph paper, lots of erasers. I often erase through the graph paper, so I need to get a new piece and start again, and just sort of fiddled with it and tried to figure out what I could do. And this took me a long time. I think this is a common thing. People who start this way are always terrible at constructing to start out with, because it's not an intuitive thing. So it takes a lot of tweaking, it takes a lot of practice. So I did this for a few years. I started when I was probably like 10 or 11 years old. I was into puzzles from a very young age. I've always been into words, so I'm a grad student in linguistics here at U of M, so anything that's about words, I'm into it. So I've always been into crossword puzzles, so I started out when I was really young, and I basically worked on it for a while. And a few years later, I started actually trying to submit to the New York Times and other places, and I think it was in 2006 that I had my first New York Times acceptance. So I would have been 16 at the time, I guess. So I started out actually around the same time that Pete was starting out. So we have pretty similar stories. Okay, so I'm gonna talk, as I said, about some of the technologies that help us as crossword constructors. So even though some of us started out with graph paper and pencil, very few people still work that way. There's all sorts of tools that we can use to make our lives a lot easier. So the major thing is that there's these software programs out there that can help you with the actual construction process. The one that I use, it's pretty popular, is called Crossword Compiler. And the interface kind of looks like this. The things that are in white are the theme entries that I put in myself. So here you can see the theme is phrases that have New York City street names in them. So you've got Broadway, you've got Wall Street, and you've got Park Avenue. And so those are all 15 letters, so they fit conveniently and they can be placed symmetrically. So Peter described this process. You put in your theme entries, you place them symmetrically, and you fill in the black squares around it. Now all those squares are in yellow. Those are ones that this program automatically filled in. So if I put the theme entries in here, I click one button, and it fills the whole thing for me, which is great. Except the fill is not very good, right? There's lots of obscure words. There's Pueller, someone who pules. I don't even know what pule means. There's Noria. Noria means an ancient Roman water wheel, I think. These are not the kind of words you want to have in your crossword, especially when you've got two really obscure words crossing each other, because then the solver, if they happen not to know those words, they've got no hope of guessing. So dopant or ovule crossing Pueller or Noria crossing Dogie, not the kind of thing that you want. So Crossword Compiler comes with a dictionary built in. It's got a word list, and you can make it fill in a grid for you using that word list, but the fill is not going to be very good. So there's a couple things you can do. Is first of all, you don't want to rely too much on this autofill, the automatic fill that it does. You can use it to help you sort of get out of a tight spot or to give you an idea of how hard some section might be to fill. If the autofill can't come up with anything for that section, you might want to consider moving the black squares around a bit, maybe switching the order of the theme entries to make it a bit easier to fill. So the autofill can help you in that way. And the other thing that most constructors do is they really develop their own word list. So whenever they come across a word or a phrase, something they find interesting and think, oh, that could be used in a crossword, you'll add it to your word list. And similarly, you'll take stuff like Pueller out of your word list because you're not going to want to use that in a crossword. So you fine-tune your word list until you get something that has only the kinds of entries that you'll want to use and not the kinds of ones that you won't want to use. So here's how the fill for this crossword actually ended up. So this is with the word list that I actually use, and this is not using so much autofill, but filling the grid in myself in the way that Peter described. So in this case, there's a lot fewer really obscure words, and there's also more multi-word phrases to try and make it a bit more interesting. So there's stuff like sly as a fox, extra mayo. Some people might not think extra mayo is a great phrase. It's sort of one of those green paint things. You wouldn't find it in a dictionary, for example. But it's the kind of thing that people say. So some people tend to disagree about this. Some people love extra mayo as a fill or as a sandwich ingredient. Some people hate it. It's divisive. And so there are all these things, extra mayo, sly as a fox, Swiss miss, that wouldn't be in the word list that Crossword Compiler comes with, but that you have to add to your own word list. Okay, so how do you develop this word list? Or if you're writing a crossword like this, and your word list doesn't have anything in it that fits the spot that you're trying to fill, what do you do? There's a couple different things you can do. Actually, I forgot to mention this. Okay, so Crossfire, I think this is what you use, right? So Pete uses Crossfire. It's basically the same basic idea as Crossword Compiler. You can get it to fill for you. You can fine-tune the word list. And there's all these sort of statistics that the program can give you. So Pete mentioned all the constraints, the sort of rules that different publishers have. So the number of words you're allowed to have, the number of black squares you're allowed to have. You don't have to do that counting by hand with these programs. It'll automatically give you these numbers. So this one happens to have 38 blocks, which is the normal maximum. So it's within the maximum, which is good. So programs like Crossword Compiler, Crossfire, are super useful for making your life a lot easier. A lot of the stuff that you have to do by hand is just a lot faster with these kinds of programs. Okay. There's this website called OneLook, which is very popular among constructors for just this situation that I was mentioning, where you've got a particular spot in your grid that you need to fill, but maybe there's nothing in your word list that fits there, or nothing that you would really like to use in the crossword in your word list. So what you can do is you just search in the search bar. You can put question marks for all the letters that you don't have, and everything that is fixed in that word, you can just enter in. So if I have an L as the second letter and an A as the sixth letter in this entry, I can just put those in, and it gives me all of these entries. OneLook combines, I don't know how many dictionaries, hundreds of dictionaries, maybe even thousands of dictionaries. Anything that's a Wikipedia entry is on OneLook, which is good because it gives you all sorts of different sources. So things that you wouldn't find maybe in a particular dictionary are going to be on here. The flip side to that is there's far too many things on here. So if you look at the answers that I'm given here, even just starting with A, there's over 100, but none of them are really words that I could use. These all look like sort of like Arabic surnames or place names that nobody's ever heard of. So I'm not going to put those in my crossword. Luckily, there's this common words and phrases filter. So all I have to do is click on that, filter by common words and phrases, and now I only have 62 things to choose from. And a lot of these are things that you could use in a crossword. So like Cleopatra, ultimatum, these are things that people have heard of. So you can filter it by common words and phrases. And the other nice thing about OneLook is that it has a mode called crossword puzzle mode, which is exactly what we need. So the normal mode would count a blank space as one of these question marks. So if you had a two-word phrase that had a blank in it, it would count it as one of those question marks. But for our purposes as crossword constructors, we want to ignore those, because those ones aren't actually going to fit in the spot that we need them to fit in. So if we turn on crossword puzzle mode, it only counts letters and letter-like symbols for the blank spaces. So it's only going to give me things that are actually going to have the right number of letters to fit in the spot. So OneLook is customizable for crossword constructors, which is very helpful. Now, in this case, the search query that I gave it is with the L and the A happens to be the Sly as a Fox entry that I mentioned right here. So it's got an L right here, it's got an A right here, and it's got all those blanks. So if I was trying to fill this spot in the grid, I would use that search query on OneLook. But if you look at the list of search results that it gave me, Sly as a Fox isn't on there. So between Slow Match and Ulaanbaatar, there's nothing. So even though OneLook has tons and tons of dictionaries that it indexes, it's not going to have everything. Sometimes there are phrases that are commonly used that just aren't in the dictionary, right? There are things that people normally say. Maybe there are sort of new, recent slang, or just the kinds of phrases that are commonly used but you wouldn't find in a dictionary. And those you might not find on OneLook. So we use a lot of technology, but we also have to make sure not to rely too much on technology. Because if I had just relied on OneLook, I wouldn't have thought of using Sly as a fox in that space, because it's not in the list. So you also have to sort of think of what kinds of phrases might fit in there, just sort of brainstorm. Okay, so these are the tools, the technologies that we use for helping us with the process of crossword construction itself. I'm going to move on now to this website called Cruciverb. And Cruciverb is more helpful with the actual selling of the crosswords. So when you've written a crossword and you want to try and sell it, submit it to the New York Times, the LA Times, or some other place, Cruciverb has all sorts of information about that. So this is one of the go-to sites that constructors use for that kind of information. So here I've got a screenshot from Cruciverb, and it's a list of what we call publisher specifications. And that has a list of all of the major publishers of crossword puzzles. So there's the LA Times, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Newsday, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and so forth. And it's got links to all of those. And if you click on the link, it'll tell you basically a message from the editor at that venue saying what kinds of crosswords they're looking for. So the basic specifications, like how many black squares you're allowed to have, how many words you're allowed to have in a given puzzle, but also things like what kinds of themes they particularly like, what kinds of words they like to have in the fill, and that sort of thing. So if you've got a crossword and you're thinking of where to send it, you can look at these specifications and see, this one might be particularly good for the LA Times, say, or for the Chronicle of Higher Education. So Cruciverb is a resource that a lot of us use for deciding where to send a puzzle that we have. Or if we're working on the puzzles, thinking about how we want to write it if we are thinking about sending it to a particular venue. Okay. Xword Info is the name of another website that we like to use. It basically indexes all of the crosswords that have been published in the New York Times and all of the entries that have been used and the clues that have been used for those entries. So let's say I've got Adele in my crossword and I want to come up with a clue for it. I can search for it and find every time that Adele has been used in the New York Times crossword and which clues have been used for it. It's kind of, I think it got a little squish, so it's kind of hard to read these clues, I think. So for example, singer of the 2012 Bond film theme was the clue for Adele in a puzzle from October this year. And so you can use this to get ideas for what kinds of clues you can use. Of course, if possible, you want to come up with creative clues of your own. So you don't want to just copy one that's already been used, but sometimes you have to do that. You can't come up with a creative clue for every single entry that you're going to use. And Xword Info can also do the same thing that OneLook does. So you can search using question marks if you're looking for a potential fill. And in this case, it's only going to give you fill that's been used before in the New York Times. So if you were trying to come up with something really creative, trying to put in a word or phrase that has never been used in a New York Times crossword puzzle, it's not going to be in here, but this is going to tell you everything that's been used. So it's a good guide to what sorts of things can be used in the New York Times crossword puzzle. So I did the same query here, and you've got a lot of the same results that we got from the OneLook search, but it's a bit different. So for example, Sly as a fox is in here. That's because it was used in the puzzle that I showed you before, which was eventually published in the New York Times. Maybe it's been used in other puzzles too. You can actually, if you click on it, you can see how many puzzles it's been used in. Off the top of my head, I don't know how many. So maybe it's been used in other ones too. And then it also has this external thing, so you can look at ones that it finds from dictionaries, similar to OneLook. So Xword Info can help you with clues, and it can also do the OneLook thing, where it can help you find entries that you could use for a particular spot that you're trying to fill. Okay, the final type of technology that I want to talk about, another type of website, and those are crossword blogs. So this is another fairly recent thing in the crossword world. The crossword community is very scattered across the world, right? As Peter mentioned, a lot of crossword constructors are very introverted. It's sort of a solitary profession, right? It's not the kind of profession where you get out and see other people who are doing it. You just do it at home, right? So crossword blogs are one way that people in the community get to know each other online. So one of the most popular ones is called Diary of a Crossword Fiend. It's run by a solver named Amy Reynaldo, and she has a team of reviewers. And every day she posts reviews of basically all of the major crosswords that are out there. So there's she does the New York Times, there's the LA Times, there's one called Cross Synergy, there's BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed has a crossword puzzle now. There's the Chronicle of Higher Education, and so forth. So she publishes reviews of basically all the major crossword venues every day, and people comment and so forth. And then another one of the popular ones, it's called Rex Parker Does a New York Times Crossword Puzzle. It's run by a guy not named Rex Parker. That's just his pseudonym. His name is Michael Sharp. And he just, as the name indicates, he just reviews the New York Times puzzle every day. But his blog is maybe the most popular one out there by readership. I'm not sure. Lots of people read his blog. He's sort of crotchety, so he can be kind of controversial. People argue a lot in the comments and that sort of thing. But it's a sort of a fun way of keeping in touch with people in the community online. So that's one of the other types of technology that we use, not for the actual constructing process or the submitting process, but just as a way to sort of keep up with the community and see who's out there and what's out there. All right, so that's all that I have. And so Tracy will be up next, and Tracy is going to give us some examples of clever clues.
Hi, nice to meet you. I should tell you something about myself. I've been in Ann Arbor for about 30 years. I also came here for college and never left. I don't know, Will, are you going to never leave also? Okay. One of the things that I use that wasn't mentioned under this topic was a page called Pat Tricks. That's a kind of a guideline about how to write clues. It's run by Patrick Merrill. It's a list compiled by him. And there are about 19 items on it, but the first three are the most important to remember, that clues have to agree in number, part of speech, and tense with the answer. So you don't want to have nouns cluing adjectives and adverbs cluing adjectives and things like that. And everything that you do when you're new is pretty important to know how to write these clues. So when I was new, I looked up on Cruciverb, and I looked up, because I wanted to submit to the New York Times, what their guidelines were for clue writing. So here they are. The clues in an ideal puzzle provide a well-balanced test of vocabulary and knowledge, ranging from classical subjects like literature, art, classical music, mythology, history, geography, etc., to modern subjects like movies, TV, popular music, sports, and names in the news. Clues should be accurate, colorful, and imaginative. Puns and humor are welcome. So puns and humor are my favorite types of clues to write, and that's what I'm going to talk about. So, can anybody think of an eight-letter word for take inventory? Shoplift. So one of the ways you can kind of tell that a clue is going to be a pun rather than just a straightforward dictionary-type clue is this question mark right here. That's kind of a tip-off that you're going to have a misdirect. A misdirect is like when you have one meaning for that phrase that you're really used to, and then they're going to trick you. And so you're going to, sometimes you don't even get it until you're done answering it, like you're done with all the crosses, and then, oh, okay, I get it. So let's keep playing. John Turingo, if you know, say. Yes. Can you explain why? John to Ringo, because Ringo is British, and a John is a Lou. Round number, four letters. Good. Refrain from farming. You guys are good. Yeah. Pass out face down.
Deal.
Union man. Did I hear it? Groom, yes. Caesar dressing. Yes. Stock exchange. Yes. Cold War ammunition. Yes. Head for the woods. Eight letters. Yes. 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 Pecking order. Two words. Kiss me. Affirmative action?
Yes.
No? Yes. Nod. Early summer. Yeah. Yeah, and that's all I have. So, okay.
And if our panelists don't mind, I do have a beginning question. It's an easy one, so I thought I would start things off with it. When you're solving, pen or pencil?
Pen.
Pen.
Well, I mainly use a computer.
I knew he was going to say it.
He's young.
But I use either if I'm solving on paper, whatever I have with me.
How many theme entries are appropriate for different sized puzzles? For instance, in a LART and a Sunday puzzle, are we looking at four, five, six, seven theme entries, two or three? I assume it varies according to the puzzle, but how many do you aim for when you're constructing?
I think you need a minimum of seven in a Sunday puzzle. Do you agree?
Yeah.
And maybe 9 to 10 would be maximum.
Yeah, so it depends on length too. Sometimes you because of the theme, you might have 8-letter themed entries and you can cram more of those in, but you might have some, you know, 15, 17 letter. So, and it's always a give and take too. It's kind of a reciprocal relationship. The more themed entries you cram into a grid, no matter what size, kind of the fill tends to suffer. So it's a balance.
You want to weigh in, Will?
Well, basically what Pete said. There's sort of a limit to the number that you can fit in. There are some really talented constructors who can sort of put a mind-bogglingly large number of theme entries in, sort of sometimes stacked on top of each other. So if you're one of those people, you can fit in tons. But for us mere mortals, there's a limit.
In the daily size ones, I think it's like the most you can really do is six.
Yeah. It starts to groan under its own weight after that.
I'm often confused about the use of foreign words in puzzles.
Say dommage.
Somebody that speaks, I mean, if they wanted to put a puzzle in Russian, I mean, nobody could get it. But a lot of, somebody that speaks French, there'll be all sorts of French words, and it can be frustrating. So how do they judge foreign words and phrases?
Well, it's one of those things where a couple in there might be colorful, but if you have, you know, 10 foreign words, you're going to put people off, like you. And it sounds like you need to go on one of those blogs and blow off some steam. And believe me, people complain about lesser things than that.
I think the most acceptable are the ones that are also used in English, you know, like mañana and things like that, that we also use in English. Those are the most acceptable.
Or ones
that
are
pretty basic.
or ones that, even if we don't use them in English, are ones that you might have learned in like your middle school Spanish class or whatever. So really common words. You don't want to put the Spanish word for hedgehog in there.
The event description says something about pet peeves, so I'd like to hear your pet peeves, but briefly, not real extensive.
Well, I think it's along the same lines. I think we've all been irritated when we've done a puzzle and we thought, how in the heck am I supposed to know that? But it's, it's funny. When I write a puzzle and if I put Beyonce in there, I'm thinking, yeah, of course, everybody should know who Beyonce is. But there are people out there who will get frustrated with that, or whether it's foreign words or places or, opera or TV shows, TV stars, whatever you put in there, you're going to be stepping on somebody's toes. It's going to be outside somebody's sphere of knowledge. So I guess it varies what bothers me. Some types of themes that are very common, I don't care for. I don't know if that's a peeve or not, but often if you've done crossword puzzles a lot, you'll get maybe four or five phrases that all end in a word that can precede another word, and make a phrase, or all the N words are kind of synonymous with each other. And that just doesn't do much for me, those kinds. So I think we probably all have puzzles types that we're drawn to and we like, and other theme types that we don't like. I'm going to speak for you, but
I don't like it when they cross two proper nouns and I don't know either one of them, because then I can't solve the puzzle at all, mm-hmm. like you said.
Mm-hmm. My biggest pet peeve is probably sometimes there are words that nobody really uses. So one that a lot of people complain about is e-mag. So e-mag is in a lot of crosswords, like an online magazine. But I don't actually know anyone who uses that word in real life. So,
Or the one that I've seen on the blogs complaining a lot about lately is Mr. Ed, the old horse, talking horse, M-R-E-D. And people say, no, it was spelled out M-I-S-T-E-R-E-D, Mr. Ed, the whole thing. So there's plenty to get under your skin if you want it to, I suppose.
The idea of reviewing crossword puzzles is stunningly new to me. What is the criteria? What are they reviewing for? I assume every reviewer is different, but tell me a little bit more about reviewing puzzles.
That was your...
As you said, everybody's different, so people have different pet peeves, they have different things that they care about more. A lot of it is sort of, is the theme interesting? Is it sort of a creative theme that really makes you think with clever wordplay, something like that? Or is it sort of one of those boring theme types where it's just a bunch of synonyms or something like that? So the theme is a major thing, and then people often talk about the fill when they're doing reviews. So if there's a lot of obscure words, a lot of abbreviations, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, different. There are four or five blogs out there that review the New York Times puzzle daily, and we'll mention the probably the two most popular. There's also a third one that's kind of the house mouthpiece of the New York Times, and that guy tends to be a little bit kinder, but. Yeah, it's like I said before, it's this teeter-totter of, when you get a really clever theme, a lot of times you have to sacrifice and you get some cruddy fill in your grid, and some reviewers on the blogs will really complain about that, and they'll like throw up their hands and say it wasn't worth it. And other people are like, well, okay, maybe he had eel crossing, ear crossing Oreo or something in the upper left-hand corner. It's all boring, but, it was worth it in the long run. I was willing to take the hit because the theme was so stellar.
And Rex Parker is notoriously crabby and hardly ever likes a puzzle very much. I call him the Simon Cowell of the crossword puzzle world. It's very hard to please, but when you do please him, it feels pretty good.
Yeah. But Rex Parker, if you watch this video, Will and I love you. I don't know.
So is it safe to say that you read your own reviews then?
Oh, yeah. And it used to bother me a lot when there would be somebody, some anonymous person in Poughkeepsie, New York, who would say, this puzzle was, and they, there's no filter. The filter comes off and you've got anonymity. And I would be like, Rex Parker, tell me who this person is. I want to send him an email personally. But now it's just like I shake my head and laugh because it's just, you know, you just can't get that worked up about a crossword puzzle. I'm sorry.
Do you all use the automatic fill-in and then, you know, edit, as Will pointed out, or do you ever just do it like the old days where you sit down with a piece of paper or, in my case, just, you know, I drew in my own grid, actually, and just start from scratch and hope that by the time you get to the last quadrant, you haven't totally worked yourself into a corner?
Mm-hmm. I've experimented with graph paper. That was really early on, before I had a mentor. I meant to mention that I had a mentor, unlike these two, and that really helped me learn the ropes before I sent things in. I still have a rejection rate at the New York Times of about 7 to 1, so it's not easy to get accepted there. But yeah, what
do you think? Yeah, I have not really gone back to just strictly pencil and paper, and part of it is just the aesthetics and the ease of having crossword software. I use Crossfire because I'm a Macintosh guy, and Will uses the Crossword Compiler, which isn't available for the Macintosh. But it's so nice, it looks so pretty, and you can change things so easily. You can wipe out a whole area without, you know, erasing it, and I'm not nostalgic for those.
You can still
days.
Do it freehand. I mean, you don't have to use the word list and
Right, and
fill.
I do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's going back and forth to the OneLook dictionary, like Will said, and going to other sources to try to come up with interesting fill. But, you know, you're not just a slave to hitting the autofill button, like Will said.
Yeah, I've never gone back to using graph paper because, as I mentioned, I would always erase through the thing. You know, there's just so many things that you have to change. It's just such a pain. If you've got the software, you might as well use it.
I love the puzzles that you do, Pete, with the circles and the, you know, and the word plays that fit in with how they are. I don't know if that's. It seems like it's more common now. I don't. Or did you have to get, you know, Will Shorts to sort of go on with this, or is it a trend? Or
well,
I'm just
yeah,
interested
I think it's
about
fairly new happening in the crossword puzzle world. And also another new thing that is very polarizing is, I don't know if you guys, if I use the word rebus squares, do you know what I mean? Sometimes they will cram 2 or 3 or 4 letters into one square without any warning. And, you know, some people just throw down their pencils and say, you know, this isn't a crossword puzzle. That's garbage. That's ridiculous. You can't do that to a person. So, things change, things evolve, and I tend to like puzzles with circles in them. But like I said, you know, a puzzle like that one that I showed you earlier with the New World Order, that ran on a Wednesday. If they ran that same puzzle on a Thursday, they might not throw the circles in there. They might expect you to go back after the fact and you know, yeah, they would take the training wheels off and have you try to spot that on your own.
How did you go, how did you find your mentor?
You must be asking me. Okay, so I started attending the ACPT tournament about 5 years ago.
Tell them what that stands for.
Oh, the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament. That's the tournament that's featured in the documentary Wordplay. And I've been a solver since I was about 16, but I wanted to compete. I thought I could compete because I won a contest here in Ann Arbor. Puzzle was made by someone in the audience, David Horowitz. I won, and so I thought I'd just do great at this tournament. And when I got there, I was in the lowest division. I think I was a little bit below the halfway mark in the lowest division. That was sobering. But I did meet constructors there, and that made me realize that this is something that people do, real people do. We have real jobs doing other things, and I thought that would be interesting to try. So first I got a few books and read them, books about constructing, and that's when I tried to work with graph paper. But the next year at the Crossword Puzzle Tournament, I found a mentor among the people that were there working as officials and also competing. His name was Victor Fleming. he's also made quite a few puzzles like Peter.
Did I have a question over here?
Well, I'm wondering if any of you did the New York Times puzzle this morning and what you thought of that Roman numeral business where you had to write in the...
That was tricky. That was really tricky.
Yeah, I did do it, and I thought it was very clever. I like that. Did you do
it? I haven't done it yet, so I have a mini spoiler, but that's okay.
I like those kinds of puzzles because I can't make them. Those are I tend to like to do wordplay mostly, and the more tricky kind of puzzles that involve a more mechanical approach and rebus squares and things like that, I don't enjoy as much making, but I enjoy doing them for that reason.
I'm relatively new to working the New York Times puzzle, and what we usually do is make two copies of it and each work our own copy and then get together on what we couldn't get. But it amazes me how frequently we'll finish a puzzle and think, oh, you know, that either that wasn't too bad, or we say, boy, that was kind of hard. And then he'll look it up and say, Rex Parker says, oh, it was easy to medium. And does he just say that all the time to make us feel bad or what?
Well, people like Amy Rinaldo and Rex Parker, I don't know how they do it, because I've even had a puzzle published and I've tried to speed solve it myself, and they do it faster than I do, when and presumably I know all the answers beforehand. So I mean, they can do a Monday puzzle in, you know, a little over 2 minutes. And I'm a pretty good solver. I'm just not fast, but it takes me, you know, maybe between 5 and 6 minutes is about as fast as I can go. And I don't know how they can do it three times as fast as I can. But yeah, so to me, the analogy is like getting a great meal put in front of you and seeing how fast you can gobble it down. That's my excuse anyway, that why I'm not a fast solver. I'd like to go slowly and savor it.
If you don't mind.
Oh, no, I don't mind. Are any of you as much into other puzzles? I mean, now that my Time subscription has these other puzzles that come along, or that the magazine now has these interesting other puzzles, I wind up doing those too. They're not my first love, but I wind up spending way too much time doing them. I was wondering if that's the same for you.
I like jigsaw puzzles. But I don't do other kinds of puzzles generally. I don't even really like meta puzzles, though I'm trying to like them. Do you know what a meta puzzle is? It's like you do a regular puzzle, but there's an extra layer where you may have to go and look something up on the internet and send in an answer. But you have to figure it out from, or you might have a series of puzzles that are published over a week. I think Patrick Barry did that once. And you have to put all the puzzles together to find a special answer, things like that.
I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about the history of crossword puzzles. When did they first become really popular?
I'm not a great historian. Anybody?
I can try. The world's first crossword puzzle was published in 1913, I think, by a guy named Arthur Wynn. And it was very sort of crude by today's standards, but that's what you'd expect from the world's first. It became popular, I think, in the 20s or 30s. It was a huge craze. It was very popular. And that's around when the New York Times started running their puzzle.
They were a little late to the game. They thought it was beneath them to do a crossword puzzle. But then they found that it would up readership, so they jumped in.
I think it's been pretty steadily popular ever since. It's not the kind of thing that runs in trends, it seems like. So.
And it is evolving, like I said, and I think Will mentioned briefly the name BuzzFeed, but they're in the, what's the other one?
The AV Club?
Yeah, the AV Club. They're now, a lot of the crossword puzzles that got published never see paper and ink. They're just online. Some of them, like, there's one called Fireball that's just purely subscription. You can subscribe to it, and once a week you get a, you know, fairly difficult, entertaining puzzle. And I don't know much about BuzzFeed and the AV puzzle. But they tend to be, you know, have a little hipper vibe to them, and maybe a little bit of language that you might not see in the New York Times, a little edgier theme-wise, and just in terms of the fill. So I think it's trending younger. Those kind of puzzles tend to.
Thank you.
One other question on the history. How did the British and American puzzles evolve so differently?
You stump me. I don't know. If people are not familiar with the British style cryptic crosswords, that's what you mean. Yeah, it's a very it's a different style. They tend to have symmetry, but they're less dense in terms of the number of answers that are in the grid. But the clues are just, to me, they're
cryptic.
They're impenetrable. Is that the word? I get nowhere on those. Granted, I haven't really tried it much, but there are these convoluted, self-referential, arcane clues that just fly right by me. And sometimes I say to myself, all right, I'm really going to learn how to do these, and I'll flip to the back of the answer. And even when I look at the answer, I've got no clue. So it's like my attempts are short-lived.
In World War II, the people who are working at Bletchley Park, which is basically the team of people who are trying to break the German code machines, they partially recruited those people by crossword puzzle contest. So it was one of those British cryptic style crosswords. And so if you could solve one of those crosswords, you were probably pretty good at breaking German code machines. And it's true. I looked at the crossword that they used for the contest once, and I got nowhere on it. It was ridiculously hard. So,
how many people do the puzzle, and have any of you considered like self-publishing? I mean, I'm sure if you got 10 cents for every solver that did the Times puzzle, you'd do much better, you know, direct to market.
Yeah, I think we are vastly underpaid, to be honest. I think we, like I said, you have $300 for a daily puzzle, and you sell them all rights, so they can put them in books. I have a neighbor who comes down once a year and knocks on my door and hands me the Delta in-flight magazine and says, look, your puzzle is in there. It's a retread, you know, it's a New York Times puzzle that got repurposed in the Delta magazine. I mean, not only do I not get an extra dime for it, they don't even tell me that they're going to use it there. So, about 6 or 7 years ago, there was talk of like unionizing or something, but it went nowhere. And to answer your question, Mike, I'm just basically too lazy and too old to investigate self-publishing.
One option for people who make puzzles is to get in at a magazine or something like that, where you have a regular gig, basically.
And do you know anybody who does that,
Tracy? I have a regular Puzzle and Bust magazine, which is a feminist publication, not what it sounds like. And that's every other month, and I have a contract with Daily Celebrity Crossword, which is an app. So it's really nice because you know they're going to take the puzzle, whereas if you submit to the New York Times, you don't know that they're going to accept it, and you might wait 4 to 6 months to find out they didn't. Then you might send it to the LA Times. If it's very literary, you can send it to the Chronicle. But that's a lot. That can take that process like 3 years. You know, if you're going to go down, and I usually give up after three.
Three strikes and you're out.
Most of us aren't in it for the money. It's sort of a hobby that we do, and we make our money other ways. So.
I agree with that. And even though it doesn't pay great, it's at least I'm making a little bit of money instead of golfing or something, where you just blow a whole afternoon and you've got nothing and you lose money.
I'd just like to ask you, how many people would you estimate contribute puzzles to the New York Times?
I think it's about 100 a year. There are 100 constructors, and every year there are, you know, new people who construct, and then every year there are people who get probably a dozen or more. You know, and after, when you do the Times puzzle on a regular basis, you get to know these constructors, and there are certain constructors you really like, and certain constructors you might think, oh, well, this is going to be another one of those kind of themes that I'm not crazy about, but you do it anyway, so.
But as far as how many Will Shortz has to deal with in a week, I think he said he has to deal with like 70 to 100 a week, so he gets that many submissions, right?
Wow.
And he's going to pick 7 of those.
Yeah, so it's, you know, 10% or less acceptance rate. And when I first started constructing, it was slow at first, and then I kind of hit my stride, and it was like I would send in puzzles, and they would get accepted, and I had, at one point I had, I think, between 15 and 20 in the, you know, in the queue waiting to get published in the New York Times, and I was like, well, I got this figured out. And of course, pride goes before a fall, and then I hit this dry spell where it's like, you know, 9, 10, 12 months go by, and it's like all I get are rejection after rejection after rejection. And so it can be humbling.
So if you submit to the...
Here we go.
If you submit to the New York Times and the LA Times and whatever, and then the New York Times accepts it, and then a month later the LA Times calls you and says, we want it too, how does that work?
You wouldn't submit to the second until you got the rejection from the first.
Ooh, it's a long process.
It's a long process, yes.
Your brain to tell us constructors,
but
what are we not thinking?
Well, I would say if you're, how many people have like a slight notion that they might be interested in constructing puzzles someday? Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, I think, I hope you took good notes or, No, but look at the video, because I think Will pointed out the places that you should go to first. And I don't know if Will mentioned, but on some of those, is it a Cruciverb? There are several helpful articles for newbies if you want to start constructing, just what to do, what not to do, what the rules of the game are. Not just the spec sheets for the individual publications, but just kind of overall, here's what you want to look for in a theme, here's what you want to look for when you're filling a grid, those kind of helpful tools. So there's online stuff out there if you know where to look. And I've mentored a few people. I don't think I'm a very good mentor, but you know, I would say if somebody's really, I've got students who've shown some interest in crossword puzzle construction. In fact, one of the people I mentored was one of my students about 6 years ago, was a senior in high school, and she became the youngest female to have a puzzle published in the New York Times. So, and I still think she has that crown. So I'm willing to help to some extent if anybody's really interested or needs questions answered. And I can give you Tracy and Will's home numbers too.
You ever construct from a symmetrical grid that's all set up?
So I've sometimes done that.
And if so, where do you get copies of these various symmetrical grids?
So
can you get dozens of these. Can you get copies of those?
Actually, so in Crossword Compiler, for example, they have a database of possible grids. So you build the grid yourself, but you can also just select one from the list that they have. Normally you don't do that if you're doing a crossword with a theme, because the grid is going to depend on the length of your theme entries and how they're going to fit. But for example, we haven't talked about themeless crosswords yet, I don't think, but I tend to write a lot of those. So that's where there's no theme. The grid is usually a lot more open than in a themed crossword, and so it's about the challenge of filling a wide open grid with interesting words and phrases.
So what sometimes, does open mean?
Lots of white space, not a lot of black squares, long entries. And so sometimes I'll take a grid, maybe I'll be solving the crossword, a themeless crossword, and I'll see a really nice grid, and I'll try to fill it myself just for the challenge.
Yeah, I've never, not even once, used a pre-cut grid for the reasons that Will mentioned. And I did mean to mention that thing about themeless puzzles, too. The New York Times, Monday through Thursday, have themes, and like I said, it gets more difficult as the week goes on. And typically, Friday and Saturday are what they call themeless, and those are the kinds of puzzles that Will described. Fewer black squares, fewer entries overall, longer entries, and tougher cluing.
And lively phrases, and to get one accepted, you have to have no crossroadies, no junk, nothing that would offend, basically.
It's becoming much more, that end of the business, I think, is becoming much more competitive, particularly because of the electronic aids that you can use in filling a grid now. So,
What is the lowest number of black squares in a crossword puzzle that's ever been made? Theoretically, you could have none. If you, I mean, so I wondered.
I'm working on that, yeah.
No, I think we're mumbling up here. I think it's 17 or 18. It might be down to 17 now, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you know?
No.
But when you do that, the fill, I think, really suffers. You get a lot of E's and R's and S's, and, you know, you get words that really don't make sense, like Pueller or Repueller or Repueled, yeah. You know, those kind of things. And they're not a lot of fun to solve in general if you're just going for a record.
I have a question. Is the constructing community affected by the fact that people can find answers online now easily, or is that just a no-no and my goodness, who cares about that?
I don't think so. I think it's totally up to the solver. Yeah. And when I was a new solver, we didn't have computers really, but I used my dictionary all the time to try to figure out new words, to learn what things meant.
I think Will Shorts has a good answer for that. He says, it's your puzzle.
Yeah.
Do with it what you will. You know, if you want to use it as a learning tool and look stuff up, I think that's great. I mean, that's part of the fun of crossword puzzles, yeah. I think, is learning new things.
I mean, that's how I feel about it, and I sort of moderate my own behavior with it, but I do use it as a way to learn new things, but I didn't know if it affected how people are writing puzzles, to look for clues that you can't just find on Google or something like that.
No, it doesn't affect me. Okay. I don't look at it from that aspect at all. But but when I solve, I don't like to look things up online. I don't want to say that it's cheating, because then that casts an aspersion on anybody who does look things up. But especially if you're starting out, I think it's great to Google something or ask somebody else. They can be as introverted as we are. You know, we do, I think solving crossword puzzles can be a good social activity, like the husband and wife back there doing it together and bouncing things off each other. And sometimes your area of expertise will fill in gaps in your partner's area of expertise.
I think we've got time for one more question. If anyone has a burning question.
How does my wife see this show?
This will be.
How does she get this?
Yep, so in a few weeks, we'll have this video. The recording of today's event will be available on aadl.org. So go there and take a look. That's where we'll have it. It usually takes about 2 weeks to turn it around and edit it and make us all sound smart and sparkly. If there's no more questions, then please join me in thanking Tracy and Will and Peter.